Well, I'd like to say I'm very happy to present today. This is actually a collaborative effort that I'll be describing, as you may already have gathered. The other collaborators are Janos Shanda, who is not here, unfortunately, but two who are, Ronnie Luo and Kevin Smet. And the title of the talk is, you know, is Meta Standards for Color Rendering Metrics. Meta standards is a fancy word, but we just mean standards about standards, and implications for spectral sets for color rendering. I'd like to begin by saying what I think we know, we all know, color concepts are confusing. And I think there really are two strong views, very strong views, that you hear everywhere about color and light sources. One of them is that color matters a great deal. I'm sure people in this room would tend to agree with that. How many of you encounter a different attitude, which is that color matters little? And it depends partly, of course, on who you're speaking to. But also, really, both statements are correct. There are situations where color matters a lot to regular people, not just us. And there are situations where it just doesn't matter all that much. Big deal, you all know that. But it creates confusion. And that confusion leads to disagreement. And right now, on the topic of color rendering, there's some really good thinking going on. But also a lot of good-hearted disagreement about what matters and how best to move forward. So that's what makes this such an exciting time, and why part of the reason for this event is to try to get more great minds worrying about this problem. So I thought I'd throw a very specific example out and be a little bit quantitative in doing so. So this is a graph. It's a graph of reflectance versus wavelength. And the bumpy graph is a particular volunteer's skin. I think it was their forearm. And the green curve is a measurement of a matched color photograph. That it was color matched to match the skin. So think of this. Imagine taking a Polaroid camera, snap a picture of your finger, put your finger on top of it, and if you got the color balance right, they're the same color. Well, of course, what I just said depends very much on the illuminant. So let's talk about an illuminant. In fact, these colors actually match under this illuminant, which is a 4100K, or maybe it's a 4500K Planckian, but a Planckian radiator. And even though, of course, these are different curves, they match because under that illuminant, they're metameric. Now, speaking of metamers, I'm showing a different illuminant here, one that consists of three LEDs, a blue, a green, and a red, fairly narrow band, and they've been attuned to have the same net chromaticity as the Planckian radiator. So we've got two light sources that have the same color, and we have two objects that have the same color under one of those light sources. And when we switch to the other light source, what do you expect to happen? Well, of course, you know what happens is they don't necessarily stay the same color. But it's important, to see this in a concrete example because these are real light sources that can be used. And so here you see the color. This is in A star, B star. Here you see the color of both of these curves under the Planckian. And when we switch to these two different sources, they switch, but they shift very noticeably, and they shift differently. And perhaps that's the most important thing, they shift differently. So here's a graphic example. Now, this is not calibrated for this screen, of course. I couldn't do that. But the differences are approximately correct. So over here, under the Planckian illuminant, you have the skin and the photo of the skin looking the same. And this depicts quite accurately the difference in the colors that result as a result of the change of the illuminant. So the key idea here, which many of you know, but some may not, is that different spectra can appear the same color and yet render colors differently. And we don't adapt to that. So we all know that we can adapt to illuminants of quite different colors and feel quite comfortable under them and judge color quite well, but we cannot adapt away color rendering error. If the colors don't look right at first, they will continue to not look right over time. And this bothers some people. This creates a sense of discomfort for some people. And so it's something that's worth talking about. And that's why historically we've had a great deal of talking about the color rendering index and needed improvements. We've already heard that there's something underway right now. There is a CIE committee, 169, that has been working on this for a great deal of time. And it looks like it's moving toward a couple of recommendations. One recommendation that I'll come back to in just a moment is this Report 1, which would recommend an improvement, which you've already heard about to some extent earlier from Yifan and Ronnie's work, an improvement of the CRI to overcome certain problems with it. And I'll be focusing on that in a moment. The second point, though, and this relates very closely to what you've heard from Kevin, is there's very widespread agreement that the CRI alone isn't the answer to improving color quality. It's an important component. It's important today because it's actually affecting choices of lamps today. It has been for some time. And so it needs to, we think, be improved and done more correctly, but it certainly isn't the end of the story. So not to in any way belittle the importance of Report 2, which we believe will simply say more work needed. And in fact, a new committee has already been created in anticipation of this call for future work along the lines of what you heard. If you'll accept that that's important, I'd like to do something much less important today, but more real and more concrete and potentially affecting things sooner, and that's to talk about report number one. And in particular, I'll be talking about the question of updating the sample set that is used to evaluate color differences. And there are two key things that need to be overcome there. One is a problem that most people are not aware of. It's probably the major point of my talk today. And the other one is there is a desire to try to keep the sample set that's used in the color rendering calculation simple and realistic. I'm not a big proponent of that latter point. I think computers can handle fairly complicated things these days, as Charles mentioned just a moment ago. But nevertheless, there is a sentiment in that direction which I can understand. So I'd like to discuss that. To do so, I do need to present a mathematical abstraction. Always a dangerous thing to do after lunch and when you're the last speaker, but it's a pretty simple one. Here it is. You've got, let's say, a Planckian radiator, and suppose we change it. So what I've shown here is a perturbation away from the Planckian shape. The perturbation is in a limited region of the spectrum, and it's designed to be color neutral. In other words, if you look at a light source that has this spectral distribution with the perturbation, it perfectly matches this one. They're the same color. But you already know that doesn't necessarily mean they will render colors the same way. So if you do a CRI calculation, a proper CRI calculation, you'll get a number for that illuminant that is less than 100 because some of the samples will undergo a color shift when they are exposed to that perturbation. But the question is mathematically, what actually causes that to occur? The answer is, when you look at how CRI is calculated, the reason that this perturbation translates into a lower value for CRI is that some of the samples, some which have reflectances as a function of wavelength, have bumps in this area. So if the sample doesn't have a curvature, it's a mathematical term, curvature in the vicinity of this particular perturbation, then it won't make a difference. So curvature of the reflectance graph of samples is extremely important to determining the sensitivity of the color rendering index to a perturbation like this. Now, the reason that that matters is that it's important for the color rendering index to be essentially equally sensitive to perturbations at all wavelengths, until you also take into account the sensitivity of the human eye, which weights that. But before you take that into account, the method we're using to calculate errors shouldn't be, you know, radically different at one wavelength than another. It should be fairly uniform. But look at what you see when you analyze that. If you take the 8 samples that are used to calculate RA in the current CRI method, what you find is that the average curvature of those samples as a function of wavelength is a really messy thing. It's got a lot of variation to it. Now, there's no reason mathematically to be at all surprised about that. It's only 8 samples. Those samples are real materials. They're Munsell samples now. They're real materials that are made of real dyes, and real molecules have quite bumpy spectral characteristics. And those bumps translate into a curvature that depends on wavelength, and even when you average 8 of them, you still get a lot of dependence. So this is just reality. The reality is that you have this very non-uniform dependence built into this standard metric. Now, I doubt the people that chose those samples would have been surprised to hear this. They just had no choice. They had no computers. But today, we aren't constrained in this way. So a number of people, one of whom you've heard today, have made the strong argument that we shouldn't be using such a small number of samples that have this problem. the world, after all, is full of a great many surfaces that have a great many spectral distributions. So we started working on that, and the group that I've referred to is a subcommittee of TC169 working on samples. And we've had a wonderful tool available to us, which was mentioned by Ifan, and is the product of Ronnie's laboratory, a 100,000 sample set of real spectral distributions that we can select from and work on and use to try to get a better representative sample set. So we tried that, and actually we estimate about 1,000 samples are needed to average out the bumps well enough that you can get a fair metric. But there's a problem. The problem is, for example, if you just take 1,000 randomly selected samples from the big data set, they may not be uniformly distributed in color space, which most people feel they should be. So that's okay. We can do that. So if you take 1,000 that are uniformly distributed in color space, you still have a problem. The problem is they're uniformly distributed in color, but if you look at the materials that make them up, it's a relatively limited number of molecules. There's a lot of overlap in the materials used, and therefore not a lot of independence in the spectra, and therefore the bumps don't go away. So what you see in this dotted curve here is the result of using 1,000 randomly selected leads spectra. And it's a slight improvement, but not a huge improvement for the reason that I've mentioned. But we've licked that problem. There's a simple solution. The solution is just to, we call it to hybridize the spectra, to use the exact real spectra exactly as they are, but to move around the location of the spectra within the visible spectrum enough to average out these bumps. So it's a detail, really, and a detail that works really well. So we've got essentially natural spectra, 1,000 of them, that produce a very uniform response in the CRI, and therefore we believe solve that problem. This still has to be proven with experimental work with real subjects, which would be the next step, but we think we have a solution. However, okay, I say 1,000 is fine. Charles, a few moments ago, said that big a number is fine. We're just two people. We find there are a lot of people that just hate that idea. They really would prefer to have a small number of samples for the purpose of calculating CRI. And so if a lot of people feel that way, there must be some truth to it. So we're trying to work on that. And the procedure that we have used to try to work on that is to develop a smaller sample set that is free of the bumps and wiggles problem and is able to emulate the results that we obtain both from the 1,000 hybrid leads spectra and also from existing human factors testing, which we have used as a reference. So so first of all, I should just say this is just a graph just to show that these hybrid spectra look very much like raw spectra. They look like spaghetti in a pot. And this is what we're trying to use as a spectral distribution, an arbitrary spectral distribution with a lot of constants that are tunable, to simulate that. Now, at first you would think, well, boy, this doesn't look at all like those. But I'll show you in a moment there is a connection where, in fact, they do. The important thing is after trying a number of shapes and a lot of optimization, which Kevin Smed has really been the primary optimizing engine for, what we have found is that we can actually get a set of spectra, I won't go into the math, other than to say it's actually really simple math. These are mathematically very simple shapes with quadratic curves melted together in a very nice way that produce this. So we call this the HL17 spectral set, and it is a set of just 17 spectral reflectance distributions that do a really good job of emulating those 1,000 samples in for the purpose of calculating CRI. And interestingly, these are not real samples. These are virtual samples. They've been defined mathematically, which some people like, but there could be an objection. Somebody could object, gee, is it possible to make these samples? So this is the purpose of the plot on the right here, where what we have done is we've selected from the 100,000 leads real sample set samples that are quite similar to the reflectance values that you see here. And they really are quite close. And by the way, we could use these too. They're not quite as accurate. So let me try to quantify that. The discrepancies that are caused by the bumps and wiggle problem that I mentioned, we've estimated to be errors of about 5 points in CRI, which is noticeable and, we think, important enough that it should be fixed. Using this sample set, that error is reduced to below 1, which we think makes it unnoticeable and we think is a good enough fix that it'll be good for all time. I should emphasize that the reason that this hasn't been as big a problem in the past as it is now is that narrowband LED light sources are particularly prone to the bumps and wiggle problem. So that's why this matters more today than it mattered in the past. But using getting back to the natural analogs, they're at an error of about 2. So they're much better than what we have now, but we really would recommend using the mathematical set, which is really free of the problem. In fact, we don't know how good it is. It may be better than an error of about a little less than 1. We won't know until we do much more sophisticated human testing. This is just a graph of what these samples look like. So plotted in various vantage points on L-star, A-star, B-star space, you can see the points are actually the 1,000 hybrid leads samples that we sort of see as, at the moment, the gold standard. And then the 17 samples that we're using, recommending now, follow just an interesting path in LAB space. You can sort of see in a kind of an artistic way they do sample that space. Not that it matters. What matters is they mathematically work. And just to demonstrate that, what you see here is a plot of the relative sensitivity of the CRI to spectral perturbation, as we were discussing, measured directly. And now this is actually including the human eye's response. So this is the whole CRI calculation, including most modern color measurement engines, color space, and color difference calculation tools. So state-of-the-art calculation. And then what we're using is just different sample sets. And looking at what happens versus wavelength. So the gold standard I mentioned, the hybrid 1,000 lead spectra, are shown in black, and matching it is the HL17 sample set. Not perfect, but very good. And I just wanted to show for comparison how, by comparison, if you don't do the hybridization trick that I mentioned, it doesn't work, and the CRI doesn't work. You get these really big variations. And those big variations, just to sort of emphasize their importance. They are the kinds of things that led to the design of triphosphor fluorescent lamps today. And there are a number, not everybody, but a number of people think that if we had made this correction to the CRI, say, 40 years ago, the average light source today could be quite different as a result of not being prone to these bumps and wiggles that kind of push designers in the wrong direction. Just a graph of performance. Actually, let me just show the one on the right here. To save time. What's being graphed here is the results with a number of different data sets in comparison to the gold standard that I mentioned. And so here you're looking at the HL17 set, and you can see that it's about plus or minus 1. This is an expanded scale here, so 5 is from there to there. And so it's a really nice fit. And as I said, it's probable that the HL17 is actually the more accurate of the two, and that most of the error is horizontal error resulting from that little bit of residual non-uniformity that was present even with the hybrid 1000 set. But the important thing is, this is another way of looking at the result, that the non-hybrid 1000 samples and the CRI samples are significantly different. So just a few conclusions. First of all, the HL17 set is proposed. Now, I want to be clear about this. We are proposing it, the subcommittee is proposing it to the committee, TC169. They may or may not accept it. But the hope is that they will accept it, meaning that it will be recommended to the CIE and to the world for consideration as a possible amendment to the CRI. It won't be the first amendment. There have been other changes in the past to improve it slightly. This is just another slight improvement. And that recommendation will include a very strong statement that this is not the end of the story at all. It's a minor but important addition to where we are today, and that'll kind of set the stage for this very important work moving forward to solve these other questions. So the result, I believe, as I said before, is that we will reduce the CRI error significantly and in a way that matters, making it possible to work well with LEDs, and to finish again, now it's time for work on color preference. Thank you.
I'm just amazed that the correlation is as saying it in advance, but my question is, why can't you use the HL 17 set with narrower bands, for example, using monochromatic LEDs? The efficiency of the reference makes no difference at all. And so the fact that some of these colors are not available efficiently, at least as far as electronic devices, is essentially meaningless.
So is your question, are we suggesting that narrowband LEDs cannot produce good color rendering?
No.
Okay,
no,
so I don't follow.
You have to have enough of them.
Absolutely.
The problem is you have to use the so-called HL17 natural color set. You could actually get normalized standards using narrowband LEDs over the entire visible spectrum.
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't you do that? I mean, it's something that could be standardized quite readily.
I have no objection to that idea. It's interesting.
Lauren, the notion of curvature is interesting and intriguing. I wonder if there is some limitation to the wavelength resolution that you need to choose in order to assess the curvature, because in theory you could get into a fractal where you would have curvatures that were enormous but didn't matter visually.
Right.
Scale.
Right. You know, I introduced that idea of curvature only as a way of trying to describe in simple terms why a small number of samples would exhibit the problem. But the actual problem that we observe is much, as maybe I could say it a simpler way. We take a source that we've perturbed in a color neutral fashion in a narrow band and look at the color rendering difference, the change in the color rendering index, in, or at least the ratio of that change to the size of the perturbation. So that's a sensitivity function. And then what we do is take that perturbation and just move it through the spectrum. So as we move it from one end of the spectrum to the other, we just look at how that sensitivity function changes with wavelength. And our feeling is that it should change with wavelength, because the human eye response characteristics change with wavelength, of course, but we don't expect jagged bumps and wiggles. Which we see, and we can clearly see what they come from. They come from features in the spectrum, in the small number of standard spectra that we're using.
An inherent resolution is being assumed.
Yes, no, there is. It's a good point. So the perturbation can't be infinitely small, and it can't be too big. And so what we do is we actually have used perturbations that are around 20 nanometer to 50 nanometer wide and just scanned them over the spectrum. Over there. And I'm cognizant that I'm the chair, so I think this should probably be the last question.
So I just want to make sure I understand. So you're proposing these 17 shapes as individual equivalent to 17 colors?
Yes, we're proposing them as a replacement for the 8 spectral distributions that are used in the RA today.
And your justification is that these 17 shapes in linear combination can match the 1,000 spectra that you pull out of the 100,000 spectra?
There's probably many ways, there's always many ways to intuitively describe something that works mathematically.
But that's what you've done, though.
Well,
saying that those 17 shapes can reproduce
yes.
the spectra.
Yes, they work mathematically, and I like your description of how they work mathematically, but I'm always aware there are usually several intuitive explanations for a mathematical truth. The fact is they work. They give results that match.
So that would mean, for one hand, you don't have any colors. Those 17 spectra have no magentas in them.
Ah, okay.
And they also wouldn't be useful for applications, particularly the art world, because a lot of colorants, in fact, have long wavelength reflectances.
Yeah.
None of your blues would represent that. So I'm not buying into your
that's fine.
Concept of the 17 being represented.
Got it. And I'll respond. You're certainly welcome to your opinion, and I can see where it could come from. In the literature, you'll find a number of places where people make comments. Well, for example, in talking about the samples that are currently part of RA, a number of people make a criticism. They say, those aren't highly saturated samples, so therefore they can't be representative of what goes on when a light source illuminates a highly saturated sample. Mathematically incorrect. It's just not true. Where the representation comes from is by the sensitivity to changes in the illuminant. And you could do this with samples that aren't saturated and detect issues in color rendering that would apply to real samples. So what we're saying is if you look at, for example, the 1,000 spectra that we're emulating with the 17, all of the colors that you've referred to that you can imagine are there. And we're averaging the color error, and we're getting a result that matches the 17. That's just a fact. So it's a surprising fact, and I can understand it being surprising, but it works. Ronnie? And then, I apologize. As the chair, I'm retracting my previous statement, allowing one more comment, and we'll wrap up.
Sorry. I think there's one thing that you didn't address in your talk. That's nothing to do with scanning. Right? The previous samples, right, is in a very few desaturated. So manufacturers can maximize their CRI, and they change the formulation. So, one task in here, right, is try to present a set of samples, try to eliminate that. Okay. And your point, right, regarding to look, I'm the artist. I'm using a very saturated yellow, very saturated magenta. You don't have this, right? But the general thing, like saying, if we have a representative set of samples that show the shift, the color shift, we have a color map, okay? So I think, right, by the end, possibly, it's sort of combination. One set is looking at the general CRI, another one is looking at the color shift, and also, right, we need to know which particular areas, which samples really matter under this particular. So it's a combination of the two, possibly will be the solution for the NCI approach.
Ronnie, thank you for that additional point, and my apologies as chair for allowing myself to have one extra question. And I wonder if we could thank not me, but the other previous three speakers for a great session. Thank you.